Good evening, Demon fans, and welcome back to the Demonland podcast. My name is Andy, and the reality bus hit the Melbourne Football Club hard on the weekend as the Demons were fumbly, inefficient, outrun, and ultimately outgunned in a 48-point loss to Fremantle in Perth. Joining me tonight to dissect a thoroughly disappointing performance by the D's at what was once something of a fortress at Optus Stadium is George. Good evening, George.
Good evening, Andy. Good evening to Bin Man. Good evening to all our listeners. Funny that you should mention the reality bus. I was going to mention it as well because two to three rounds in to the season, and it certainly has struck a number of teams, including Melbourne. But let's hope that it doesn't back up on us for a second crack this week.
Well, hopefully it was just a reality minibus and not one, not a big big school bus.
Well, it's picking up passengers at the moment, so could be getting heavy.
Also joining us to unpack everything that went wrong, or right, maybe in Bin-Man's point of view, is Bin-Man. Good evening, Bin-Man.
Yeah, look, I know I skew positive, but some of the carry-on on Demonland, if that's indicative of Melbourne fan base, which it pretty well is just way over the top. I mean, even the sort of reality bus stuff, like we're coming up against a genuine flag contender, top four on their home deck. The last half a dozen, I think eight times we've played them, our average winning loss is 50 points. We have talked on this show, like it's a semantic discussion. Are we in a rebuild, a reset, a refresh? George said definitely a rebuild. So I don't know what reality, like that. It was no surprise whatsoever what happened. We talked last week about the, you know, the big concern for me was our defensive system, how that would hold up to their run and carry. And they dominated in the first quarter, but there was a lot to positives to take out of it. Like the last three quarters, we matched a top four side, and you can say all you want about, well, they put their cue away. They didn't. We had an excellent last three quarters. We basically matched, as I said, a top four team. A lot of positives to take away from it. And I just think that, you know, we're, if you accept that we're in some sort of reset, rebuild, then one, it's just a fact of life that development's not linear. To a team that it relies so heavily on the quality young players is always going to have inconsistent performances. And on the weekend, there was a perfect example of that. So if you put together an argument that the D's are in a rebuild phase, well, obviously North are in a rebuild phase as well. Every man and their dog was lauding the win over Port, which was an impressive win last week. They went across to Perth. They were $1.50 favourite to win that game, despite the fact that they finished 17th last year, despite the fact that they were playing in Perth. It was money for old rope on that West Coast bet. They were $1.50 favourite. They kicked seven goals in the first quarter to Eagles three, led by four goals. Looked that, you know, the odds looked every bit correct. They ended up losing. They only kicked another seven or eight goals for the game. They ended up losing to West Coast, who hadn't won a game since round 10 last year. And that's what happens to young teams that have got are in a rebuild phase that relies heavily on young guns like us. So for me, it wasn't a reality bus, it was just footy. And I actually think the performance wasn't nearly as bad. I mean, the first quarter was diabolically bad, but they played amazing. And so I just don't think it was as big a negative as everyone seems to be carrying on about.
Our average age was older than Fremantle. I will just remind you of that.
Yeah, of course they were. But, yeah. Like, you know, they've got a much better top-end spread of, yeah. I mean, we just got rid of three All-Australians. So our quality is in our younger players outside of Max. So our gun players are younger players, just like the Roos, just like the Tigers as well for that matter. So, yeah, our average age was, which is why, you know, which is why I don't think we are in a rebuild phase. It's why I think we're in a reset phase. But either way, it's a semantic argument. We're always going to struggle. The line in that game was 20 points. And someone asked me whether that was value, you know, and I said no. Like, I would have backed over if I was going to back anything against Melbourne. I would have easily backed that. I would have had the line at 30. So to lose by 48 and basically be level pegging after quarter time was about what I expected, to be perfectly honest. So it's, you know, we're even if you're skew optimist like me, we're a bottom sort of 9 to 10 team. We're playing a team that has, I think, a genuine shot at winning the flag this season. So, you know, I think people's expectations should be sort of tempered, I think. And we, you know, if we're talking reality, let's talk about the reality of who we played and where we are in our rebuild, reset, refresh stage.
I think we're doing more of a renovation.
Yeah,
the garden's a mess. Exactly. Yeah. The neighbours are complaining.
Yeah, except we've knocked the house down.
and look, it is a issue that I know I've just so someone told me that Gary Lyon's been talking about it as well, and I've been talking about this for 3 years. There is a big gulf between the top three or four teams in the AFL and the rest, I reckon, and we're in the rest, and I think we're in that middle thing, and we're above the bottom four teams, bottom three teams. But you know, we're obviously a ways off the Suns and Frios of this world. So,
all right. Well, each week I invite our loyal listeners to support the podcast by leaving us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts, and we truly appreciate your feedback. And as a token of our gratitude, we give a well-deserved shout out to those who do take the time to share their reviews. And hang on, Helmers on the way writes, "Love the stats files. No need to keep it short." Thanks for the feedback. Hang on. Much appreciated. Keep the feedback coming in 2026. Simply leave us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts, and we will give you that shout out on the show like we just did for Hang On Helmers on the way. And that 5-star review is the perfect segue into our next bit of housekeeping, because if you love the stats file segment that Bidman does each week, then you'll be very happy to hear that it now has its own companion podcast, The Stats Files, presented by our very own Bidman. And as part of our effort to trim the rundown of the main podcast, we've been looking at which segments could be reshaped without losing what makes them valuable. And one segment that naturally came into focus was Bidman Stats Files, and not because it isn't important, but quite the opposite. It's become such a substantial and well-loved part of the show that it really deserves a little room to breathe. And the Stats Files is one of the things that gives the podcast its unique flavour, but it also takes up a fair bit of airtime. But just importantly, it does take a lot of preparation from Bidman behind the scenes, especially with the tight turnaround required to bring you the live podcast on a Monday night. So rather than lose it all together, which we're never going to do anyway, we're just evolving the format. Bidman will still present the abridged version of the Stats Files, which you'll do shortly on this main podcast. But for those who really like to sink their teeth into the numbers, we've launched that midweek companion podcast featuring the full-length version. So fans of the Stats Files, don't worry, it isn't going anywhere. It's just getting its own stage. So hang on, Helmer's on the way. And for everyone else, don't forget to check out the Stats Files, which will appear in your podcast feed in the coming days. And now, I know a lot of people never had a problem with the length of the show. We regularly went past the 2-hour mark, or more often than not, landing around 2 hours 20, sometimes nudging 2.5. And I certainly didn't have a problem with that. And I know many listeners didn't either. But having said that, a handful of people were quite up front sometimes letting me know that they did think it was too long. But my push to shorten the show wasn't just about listener feedback. It also came down to the sheer amount of preparation I was putting into it. It was taking time away from family and work, and it was all starting to become a bit much. And if I was going to keep the podcast going, and let's be honest, it can be a little harder to stay motivated during the lean times. I felt that I needed to make things easier on myself, and that meant trimming things back. And it's not just the stat files that have been adjusted. Other segments have been shortened, and some things have been cut out altogether. It also means, you know, we're all going to be conscious of trying not to be too verbose and repetitive. And of course, though, we're just humans at the end of the day, and sometimes our passion does get the better of us and we can't help ourselves. But anyway, I'm aware that in the process of explaining why the show needs to be shorter, I've once again probably made the show longer by being overly verbose myself. So you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X if you want to leave feedback, ask a question, share a comment for the show, jump into our weekly podcast posts, or send us a DM. You can listen to the Demonland podcast on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or your favorite podcasting app. Just search for Demonland podcast and subscribe. And to connect with fellow Demon supporters, head on over to demonland.com, sign up for free, join in on the conversation with Demon fans from across Australia and around the world. And if you want to call into the show live, give us a call on 0486 387 929. That number again, 0486 387 929. If you're listening live on your phone via demonland.com, just hit the call button and it should automatically call you from the phone app. And during the week, you can call that number, leave a message for us to play on the podcast. And during the week, those calls go straight through to voicemail, so you won't have to speak to a human. Listen to the podcast live every week on demonland.com on Monday nights at 8 p.m. So, Bin Man, take it away with your abridged stats files. And don't forget to check out on your podcast feeds in the coming days for the full stats files.
Thanks, Andy. And I'm aiming to get that. My aim is to have that out on Tuesday, so Wednesday at the latest. So a review of the last game and perhaps a little bit of sort of, you know, as the season goes on, looking at some trends and perhaps a quick look at the game coming up. So in terms of the stats files here, I just as a thing for I listened to it back, and I'll say this on the thing tomorrow, on the pod tomorrow when I record it, but I didn't have a sort of structure in mind. I listened back and decided I need a structure. So I'm going to try to bring that in, bang on somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes, and I'm going to be focused on the four.
I'll add my two cents. You can make it as long as you want. It is a separate thing.
Yeah, I know. But
I mean, don't make it 3 hours, because then we'll be cutting that down and having a third podcast.
The discipline of getting it. You know,
it is good to have a structure.
Being tight. So, and that's why also I'll be doing a structure, which will be the four phases of the game, and the four phases of the game are when offense, defense, and trend, and when the ball's in contest and team hasn't got it. So you either got the ball, you're either defending the ball, or the ball's in contest. They're the three phases. But increasingly, coaches are talking about a fourth phase in footy, which is transition, and when the ball's in transition. So I'm going to structure the multiverse universe, the Demonland universe show stats file offshoot around those four phases. And then really just sort of more focus on this, on some key stats where they're winning and losing for the main pod. And also more of a focus on this pod on the player ratings and equity points than the main pod. So, and I'll try to make sure that I'll bang on 10 minutes for this. So I'll get going. I know I talked about this last year, but just to frame this, because I'll be talking about player ratings and in particular ball use equity and ball winning equity through the season. The short version of the player rating systems, the Champion Data player rating systems, is it's a measurement of the direct impact each player has on a game through their actions that affect either the ball or ball carrier, expressed as a scoreboard impact, which is why I love it, because it talks about impact. So the combination of, you know, what is a player's impact on the actual game. To get the measurement, three factors are considered for each action, the location of the ball on the ground before and after the action, the situation before and after the action, and then the difference in next expected score, NES value, before and after each action. So basically it says, so for example, Maxi gets the ball, it's on a scale of -6 to +6, depending on whether you hurt your team's chances of, increase the opposition's team chances of scoring, or you increased your own team's chances of scoring. In the example of Maxi Gorn, the ball's thrown up in the center after a goal. He takes it out of the ruck, runs 30 meters or 20 meters. No one provides a shepherd. There's no other action or involvement from any other Melbourne player, and he kicks a goal. He would get 6 points for that action. If he handed it off to Cozzy, each would get 3 points. If someone shepherded and that was a key part of that score being gold, they would also get points. So actions that increase a player's team's chances of scoring next, example, taking possession, moving the ball forward, give positive ratings, and actions that decrease the chances of your team scoring, example, turning it over, missing shots at goal, like an easy shot directly, give negative ratings, and the player rating each player gets is the sum of all of those ratings. So that's one of the things I really like about it, is that it measures scoreboard impact, the actual impact that player has on the game, as opposed to things like how many kicks they got, and that doesn't give any sense of the quality of their involvement. It's got some weaknesses, one of which is that it consistently, because it emphasizes an indexes goals, it consistently, it's harder for defenders to score because it's harder for them to positively contribute directly to a team scoring, and it's easy for them to be punished for a turnover and the opposition scores. The equity use is really interesting. I find it's something that Wheelo's done to give a more nuanced way of determining when all of the points are aggregated up across the team of how well a team wins the ball and how well they use the ball, but not just how often they do those two things, which is what contested possession, measures for ball winning and disposal efficiency and kicking efficiency is used as a proxy for how you use the ball. That rating actually gives some sense of actually how well those things are done in order to increase your team's chances of scoring or directly releasing, or the opposite as the case may be. Ball winning equity measures the points added to a team's expected score specifically from the act of winning a possession in dispute, hard ball gets, loose ball gets, intercepts, etc., etc., etc. That gives you your ball winning equity rating aggregated up across the team. And ball use equity, you get points for an action that moves the ball into a better scoring position or actually results in a goal, and obviously a goal. And you lose points, a player loses a points for a turnover, missed shot, a backward move that decreases the team's immediate scoring probability. When you aggregate all of them up, you get into player rating. You get into an aggregated ball winning measure and an aggregated ball use measure. The player ratings, so it's relevant for this discussion now. The player ratings, the top five rated players for this game were Maxi Gawn. God, he must have the record at Melbourne for the highest, like he's invariably in the top one, two, three, isn't he? So his rating was 20.8. Cade Chandler was next. He was excellent across all four quarters, 15.9. Cozzy was third, which was a little bit of a surprise when I saw the ratings. He was third, highest rated player. Harry Sharp, who was fifth last week, had another great game, carried on his form. He was fourth, highest rated player with 13.2. And I was really pleased to see this because after last week, Langdon was the lowest. And I mentioned this last week. I can't remember if it was on the other pod or this, but he's disadvantaged because you don't get any points for unrewarded running, though you do get points for corralling and pressure and all the things related to that. But he was our fifth highest rated player with 13 points. Maxi totally maxed out. He was our best ball winner. And so this is where it's relevant. He had 16.7 of the total points that he got, the 20 points that he got, 20.8 points, were gained winning the ball. So he was our by far our biggest, our most successful ball win. So not only did he win the ball, we often scored when he won the ball. That's what that measure says. But it's a bit of a worry that he was our number one. Number two was Jack Steele with 13.1 ball winning points. But his ball use points, Jack Steele's ball use points, was negative 4.1. So he had a total of 11.6, but he lost, that was his match total, but he lost negative 4.1 for his ball use. And that was a real worry. So, Maxi gets the ball. His ball use was average 2.5. Kate Chandler's ball use was really good, 7.9. This was a massive surprise. Our best user of the ball in this match was Sharpie, 8.2. Super impressive. Obviously you get points, good points for scoring goal, and he scored a couple. So where you can look at this in terms of the ball use in equity is our disposal efficiency was 68.8, and theirs was 73.4.6. Our kicking efficiency was almost as good as theirs. 64% of the time our kicks hit a target, 66% of the time their kicks hit a target. So almost the same in terms of kicking efficiency, but that doesn't tell a tale, which is why Wheelo started using these stats. One, because it gives a more accurate measure of actually how teams win or use the ball, but two, there's a very strong statistical correlation now between how well teams win the ball and how often they win the game. And so that's where the equity points is terrific, as I said, as it provides a much more nuanced analysis. So for our kicking efficiency, as I said, was almost on par for them. But when you look at it through the lens of equity points, is we won the ball all right, 118.9 points to theirs, 119. So we won the ball almost as well as them. But our ball use, they just smashed us for ball use. So we aggregated up 26.9 points for ball use. They had 71.3% for ball use. They just scored more often. They punished us so much more with our ball use, whereas we just were kicking around. And for me, that's a really interesting measure. Meters gained from handballs was a really interesting stat that I talked about last week. We were plus, I couldn't believe it. And I checked, double checked. This Saints only had 10 meters handball gain last week. They only had 21 this week. They're bottom of the ladder with 31. The AFL average for handballs gain, meters gain from handballs this year is 241. We're averaging 228. We were at 226 in this game. But the big thing is that they averaged 331 meters gained by kicks, meters gained by handball. 110 of them were in the first quarter. That is unbelievable. So in that first quarter, if you think back, they just dominated with handballs forward. They had 72 more handballs than us and 82 more handball receives. They just really ran us into the ground. That was fascinating. If you look at the handball, meters gained by handball, it's becoming increasingly a feature of the game and how it's played across the AFL. The handball is the Suns are like 600 meters per game in terms of handball, meters gained from handball, which is really fascinating. Just on that, just really quickly, forget goodies being long down the line. We are a territory team, and I think it's super important to remember that. We're wanting to move the ball fast, but we have gone back to being a territory team. Meters gained per kick is above AFL average so at the moment, and way and above where Goody was last year, or in terms of Melbourne were last year. It's very similar in many ways to the methodology or the method that Goody had in 21 through to 24. Some other key stats for that first quarter: we lost the game in the first quarter. After that, we broke even. The Frio's first quarter was the highest score ever against us. The first quarter ever against us. In fact, their highest scoring quarter against us, full stop. They had 25 inside 50s in the first quarter, the most they've ever had in the entire history of their footy club. 25 inside 50s is unbelievable. Now, the defense really struggled with the pressure. We'll talk about it through. Our fumbling was really bad, but fair's fair. 25 inside 50s is just berserk. By just sort of get a handle on that, they had 58 inside 50s for the match. With 25 but coming in the first quarter, that means they only had 33 inside 50s for the last three quarters of the match. So it's no wonder our back D was under so much pressure and struggling. With the ball coming in that fast, that often, I think a real lens needs to be looked at the all-team defense. Where was our midfield slowing their run? Where was our runners? They completely smashed us in terms of uncontested possessions in that first quarter. They had nearly 40 more uncontested possessions than us. They had, as I said, 72 more handball receives than us, reflecting their run across the game. They had 82 more handballs than us. That's a lot, but it really reflects the method. Very similar game plan Melbourne has to the one Long Muir is trying to put in place at Frio. The difference is we are a much more territory side. So we will be low disposals this year, low kicks, low handballs, despite what, you know, the sort of thought might be. King's been very clear about that. So get it forward. Really interesting stat that Hoyne talked about last week in the Saints game. In the Saints game, we had the opportunity to switch the football laterally 27 times and only did so twice. That's completely different to the way the Saints play, for instance, and other teams play. 95% of our kicks went forward, which is remarkable, really reflects what King's trying to do in terms of the footy we're going to play. Just a final comment on this game is our running was way down. So a really good data source is the tracker on the AFL.com on the app. If you go to the match stats, there's a tracker, and I don't think it is on the AFL on a website, on the normal website, and you can see a whole number, you know, the top five across a whole lot of, and we were down across the board in our defensive running, and there's a question on that that's coming up, and yeah, I've got a bit of a theory but on that, but the bottom line is that we on a 6-day break, it makes a big difference. And I wouldn't be totally shocked if few of the players were carrying a flu or something, because we look completely off in that first quarter. The other, just quickly, they smashed us for pressure. We only had 140 pressure points in our last quarter. They had 26 more than us. Just tells me that we were really sort of gassed and trying to find the line at that point. And they had 19 more contested possessions than us, so completely and utterly demolished us on that front. The other one, they had 19 more ground ball gets than us. They were very impressive, I have to say, a very impressive team. And, yeah, a lot to like in the last three quarters, but that first quarter was diabolical.
Yeah, I would say, and I think there's a question that sort of tackles it a little bit, I'd say the weather 2 weeks in a row. I mean, it wasn't extreme heat last week, but it was hot weather
in
the
25.
Sun. Yeah, 25 in the sun. This was hotter than that. This was 30 plus. So
and they
excuses, but that definitely contributed.
Absolutely, it definitely contributed. You could see right from the get-go, bloody Howes looked like he would, you know, he was losing – like it was 85% humidity at when the ball was bounced, 85% humidity, 28 degrees. The heat, whatever that heat rule is, was introduced with the longer three quarters. And I watched the Eagles Roos game last night, very similar, almost identical conditions. Eagles went into their rooms at quarter time and three quarter time, such was their concern.
Are you allowed to do that?
Yeah, well, that under the heat rule, I think.
The heat rule. Yeah.
All right, let's get into some listener questions. Lazy writes, there was a great stat that showed our top four on average centre bounce appearance players in 2025 versus so far in 2026. In 2025, it went Oliver, Cozzy, Viney, Track to Cozzy, Steele, Windsor, Rivers so far this year. We were beaten around the midfield early, but when you look at the CBA comparison between 2025 and 2026, it does help explain why. Cohesion in a regular midfield group takes time to build, and coming up against a powerful, established unit like Fremantle's was always going to be a serious challenge. In that sense, we were up against it from the outset. Realistically, it may take half a season for this group to truly gel, and that's before you even factor Jack Viney coming back into the mix. As fans, we've been conditioned to expect a midfield that wins the contested ball week in, week out. But with that era now in the rearview mirror, do we need to reset those expectations? Is it a case of accepting the imperfections of this new group and trusting the process? Personally, I'm less focused on wins and losses this year and more interested in seeing a style develop that will eventually stand up against the best sides. So, George, I'll throw this one to you. Is this simply a case of being patient with a new-look midfield, or are there changes you'd be looking to make, or is it more of a question of whether we've actually got the cattle to go with the best midfields in the competition right now?
I think the answer's more in the third option there, around the cattle. You don't lose two multiple All-Australian and club champions in over a summer period and expect them to be replaced instantly. It takes a couple of years till you get to those quality players available to you in the draft, and then to be able to develop. We've also lost Jack Viney. I would be very surprised if he's back in any form whatsoever this year, given that he his injuries over the summer period. So again, another top quality player who we have yet to replace, and all we've got, you know, Jack Steele has been a genuine steal for us. He's able to get the ball plenty, but we're still two players short in the middle from where we were in terms of the quality. And we're trying to fill it with people who really have got no background in the middle. Windsor, I've been disappointed in people like Sparrow, Rivers, not really providing anything to this stage. They should be showing a lot more, but they're not. They're not midfielders. They're not prime midfielders. And until we get some of those, we're going to be facing this for a couple of years. I've been a bit disappointed in Langford, whether he's not being used correctly or not. I really thought that this was the year that he was going to step up into the midfield. He's got the body already. He is a genuine midfielder. He knows how to get the ball. But certainly in the last two games, that he's either got something wrong with him, or he's not quite right, or I don't know what. But they certainly haven't used him in there. Cozzy, we've always had used infrequently through there, and there's probably a need for him more so during this season because of the loss of our major midfielders. But it's not just in the centre bounce that we need to be looking at. It's around the whole ground, and this is where we're really suffering. We've got people who are being expected to do something that's beyond them ultimately, or they're not up to it, or they're, you know, at a low stage in their development. And it was really telling in that first quarter. It's not about, as Binman mentioned in his stats, where were the mids in the first quarter? Where was the all-team defence? That the ball goes into the opposition's forward line. What was it, Binman? 25 times?
25, which is, 25, I don't know what that must be one of the most we've ever given up. That is, you do that for four quarters, you're getting 100 inside 50s.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's coming from up the field. It's not the defenders are the problem. I mean, I think there's other problems there, but there's just not the individuals who are putting in the required defensive mode further up the field to stop that, or restrict it, or defer it, so to speak. So we've got a long way to go. I really worry that if we keep playing Windsor to the extent that we have been, that physically we'll kill him after about six rounds. I hope that doesn't happen. I held my breath during this game when he was holding his shoulder there at one stage. I thought, God, he's dislocated it, but fortunately it looked really bad. But that's the nature of playing in the midfield all the time, that you're coming up against big, solid, seasoned bodies as a general rule, and he's got his own individual talents and things, but he's not built for them, I don't think, yet. So it's a real pity. But the other sad thing is, Binman might talk about this later on, he saw the Casey game. I watched it on the streaming service. Bailey Laurie is the sum total of our midfielders at Casey. There's no one else that's coming through. So until we get the top end sort of draft picks in the coming year, we're going to we're going to be facing the same situation again and again as we come up against these top sides.
Just with that, one of the interesting things, and this is what sort of this is what drove Willow to look at ball winning equity and ball use equity, is the way footy's trending, interestingly, is away from winning stoppages and clearances being the key thing to how well you use the ball and on turnover. And like we talked about last week, this is it's obvious the Kings trying to develop a suite of players who can run through the middle. And I mentioned last week, I wouldn't be surprised if Cully ended up coming through the middle, and he took at least one in this game, centre bounce. But you still got to win the ball, like from stoppages. Our scoring from stoppages, we got smashed in this game. The way the Dogs are playing is really interesting, because they're the only team really sort of being dominant. And Carlton, who we're coming up from, their scores from stoppages being the critical piece of their puzzle, when not ball winning. Ball use. For me, the big thing, and it sort of goes to this next question, Andy, really is how well we use the ball, and that's what we're trying to shift towards. And, you know, we're in a lot better shape than we have been for the last 3 years in how we're using the ball, even in this game, actually.
All right, we'll get to that shortly, because first we're talking about Trent Rivers. Harp and D asked, is Trent Rivers a midfielder? Spiro and Norm Smith asked the same question, asking, is Trent Rivers a midfielder? He will develop more with more time. However, I'm not sure he's the natural midfielder type. He's missed a few crucial tackles to lock the ball in and allowed Freo's mids to get their disposals away. He was such an excellent halfback as a competitor, good mark and tough running rebounder. Bowser Power adds, what makes Rivers a midfielder? What will he offer us that few others can't? So B-Man, simply put, is Trent Rivers a midfielder? And George sort of alluded to it. We've got a couple of players that are playing in there that aren't first choice mids.
If I was honest, I always sort of struggled to see him in the midfield, but in large part because of the way he uses the ball, is you really need to have, you know, if you're midfielders are the players most likely to be kicking it inside 50, and so you need players with good foot skills coming inside 50. It makes such a big difference. Having said that, I think it sort of goes to George's point. It's like you've got to have someone in the midfield. If he's, we've got players who can play at halfback flank. He is strong over the ball. The worry about for me as a midfielder is his the quality of his ball use. But, you know, in this game he had 501 metres gained, fantastic from the midfield. Like, that's often a number that the halfback flankers, you know, particularly if they get to take kickouts. He didn't take any kickouts. He had 3 inside 50s. He had 7 score involvements, which really surprised me. Team high 7 score involvements, which probably showed a bit of this game in some ways. The top of the top 8-9 score involvements, 8 of them were Freo players or something like that, and he was our top number of score involvements with 7. Really, my point, and this is why I quite like this equity point notion about ball use, his disposal efficiency was 81% for this game, which on paper sounds all right. Like 81%, you know, disposal efficiency ain't too bad. But when you look at it from an equity point of view, he had his player rating for this game was 4.5. 4.1 of those points he accrued by getting the footy or in the contest, which is his strength. That's his one wood. He only got 0.2 for ball use, meaning that when he did get the ball, he either didn't do anything positive with it or actually turned it over and hurt us. So for me, that really sort of highlights the issue I see him as a midfield. He's not going to be one of those damaging by foot players that are sort of spotting up someone with a laser-like kick going inside 50. And if he's going to play midfield, as George talked about last week, you know, we need our midfielders kicking goals. And he's not, he doesn't, a bit like my criticism of Klaz always was of Clary, he doesn't kick enough goals. I mean, if Trent River is due, he hasn't played that many games as a mid, but I think he's got to be kicking some goals. But his score involvements, to be involved in 7, you know, was terrific. He had 10 pressure acts, which was excellent. And so is he in midfield? I think he is at the moment. You know, it'll be really interesting to see what we do down back. I will talk about it later perhaps, but I think AMW will come back in pretty soon, and hopefully Bowser's not a million miles away. So at the moment, a bit depends on how they use Langford. I agree, totally agree with George. He was disappointing in this game and he was disappointing last week. A little bit, I'm a big sort of believer in body language, and his body language hasn't really super impressed me, and, you know.
We'll get onto that soon because there is a question about him. Well, let's talk about ruck selection and planning. Radelaide writes, the Turner injury aside, because that was an unforeseeable incident, should the D's have brought in another ruck, Max Heath? Perhaps. Max Gorn had already busted a gut in the last quarter and a half the previous week, and they also knew this game was going to be played in extreme heat for the second week in a row. We already knew that the Dockers had a stacked forward line with key position players who were always going to stretch us whenever Petty had to go into the ruck. The disco injury only made matters worse and eventually forced us back to using JVR as the backup ruck. Yes, there was some rotten luck involved, but this was already shaping as a situation that was going to test us badly. In my opinion, that points to poor planning. Gorn of the Dead asks, at what stage will Big Moose get the call up? But Big Mac Senior can't do this on his own, which is evident against strong double rucks like Jackson and Darcy. What's your thoughts on when the succession plan will fully kick in, and instead of being the backup, Moose will start getting game time and actually start getting the experience he will need to take over when Max Senior departs? Monocular says, even the mighty Max Senior won't be able to sustain so much ground time, and we definitely need him in big games and big moments. Can you conceive a method to ease Max Jr. Sometime soon? Ease in Max Jr. sometime soon. George, is this a list management issue, a selection issue, just rotten luck given the circumstances of an unforeseeable in-game injury? And before you add, I'll just add that I don't think that even Max Jr., Max Heath, was the one planned to be the backup ruck. Of course, we know Luca Kenfield was in line for that, and rotten injury and rotten luck has stopped that.
I think all our listener contributors are all exactly all right. Firstly, you know, Darcy and Jackson are two very, very good rucks. For a start, there was not going to be any relief for Max Senior during the whole game, and there wasn't. And what I really fear is that he's carried the load now for 2 weeks, and especially off this game where in hot conditions, I don't know that we might see the best out of Max next week, simply because we're grinding him down, and I think unnecessarily. Again, Bin Man can confirm it. But from what I saw, Max Heath in the Casey game this week was one of the standouts. in terms of what he was doing around the ground in the ruck. There wasn't much else to go on in that game from what I saw, but he was certainly capable, more than capable. And the reality is that even having the, you know, you can go in with the theory that having the extra small man on the bench is what we want to do. Well, it didn't do us any favours in this game. What we really needed was another tall body, and as you know, you can't help bad luck, but that's exactly what happened when we lost Disco, and all of a sudden we had people playing all sorts of weird and wonderful locations on the field trying to fill the hole that was there, that was created. Yes, we should have had him in the team in the first place. The opportunity is this week. At what stage do you think you have to introduce Max Heath if you're not going to do it at a game like this one? There are no teams that have got no ruckman. So here's the opportunity when they've only really got one ruckman in Pittner who's not the world's best in the first place. But here's the opportunity to bring in a young guy, get him some exposure, or are we going to wait until Max Senior gets injured before we put him in? Give him a run this week and see what he can produce, and let's see what the outcome is. But certainly we need to start using him for what he's there for.
Yeah, I guess I don't think he'll be brought in. I didn't think he'd be brought in for this match. I don't think he should have been brought in. I don't think we did actually need another big player. Harry Sharp was viewed, whether rightly or wrongly, as that fifth player. He's been in our top five players both weeks. If we had another big fella, they would have just run off us even harder. It's like we couldn't have carried a big fella. The issue wasn't our lack of height. We actually remarkably took 12 intercept marks. That was massive. We only lost 33% of our one-on-one defensive one-on-one thing, which is excellent. Not as excellent as Frio's, though. They didn't lose a single one-on-one defensive contest, not one, which is bananas. If we had Heath in this game, they would have won by more because what they beat us with is their run. And we, you know, it's like in seasons gone past, is we just could not cover their run. You need, like, the game plan that King is trying to implement is so aerobically taxing. If anything at all reduces that capacity to cover ground, whether it be fatigue, the heat, whatever, we are going to suffer, particularly at this early stage of our game plan where we're not looking for plan Bs, we're trying to implement a method. If you added another big bloke to that, they just would have torched us even further, I reckon.
They were able to use Darcy, who's as slow as a wet week.
He was hopeless. Darcy was hopeless. He was absolutely hopeless. Yeah. And I think he must have only been 50% game time. And but the only other big guy is for them is Jackson, who's a midfielder. Like he's a running machine now, Jackson. So it's not like for like. They didn't, you know, whilst they had two ruckmen, there's no chance, like, they won't be picking Heath this week. And for the foreseeable future, it'll be Maxi. I think we'll need to get used to that. And they'll use Cully and I reckon Kentfield. And they'll use him when they bring him in, is my suspicion. I don't think we'll see Heath at all. I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't play a senior game this year, or if he does, not to the back end of it. He was good against Footscray. He was big, strong, looks a natural footballer. He's a big lump of a lad for 22 years old. They smashed us in the midfield, absolutely obliterated us. And a big part of that was he was hitting to them for most of the match. I don't think he's ready, to be honest, to come in and play it. But, you know, he was good, and I think he's really is got a lot of future. I think he's a great pickup. I'm really bullish on where he'll end up, but I can't see him coming into the ones to the back half of the season, would be my vibe.
Oops, I was on mute. Pew asks, any thoughts on why our disposal was so poor on the weekend? I know we're not the most skillful side in the competition, but at times our use of the ball was absolutely diabolical. It wasn't just by foot either. Some of the handballing was just as bad. And to make matters worse, we were incredibly fumbly at times, spilling handball receives and dropping a couple of absolute sitters. Was it simply the pressure Fremantle applied? I'm not convinced it was the conditions, because the Dockers didn't seem to have the same issues with ball in hand. Demon WA says, Freo were absolutely clinical when we fumbled, and equally it seemed like every time the Maggots didn't pay us a holding the ball would spill out and they'd take it coast to coast. I guess the point is that I cannot imagine that happening every week. We were off and they were very on. It was a hot and humid afternoon, and I think the conditions definitely played a part in how the first quarter unfolded. It was one of those rare occasions where the home ground advantage wasn't just about crowd support. The conditions compounded the Dockers' advantage along with the Maggots. And Wells 11 says, so many of our fumbles and turnovers led directly to goals, and while a few players like Rivers and CJ seemed particularly affected, it certainly wasn't limited to them. So the question is, was that simply a bad day at the office brought on by the pressure Fremantle applied, whether real or perceived, against a very good side, or does it point to something more concerning, that our defensive structure is now too easily exposed when we try to get forward of the ball? So B-Man, skill execution, pressure, system breakdown, I suspect it's a mix of all three. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you really could, this doesn't make sense, you could look at this as two halves of a game, even though it was one quarter. I mean, all of the damage was done in the first quarter.
But after in that, the third, they sort of piled on quite a few goals.
Yeah, but we still matched them, you know, we still actually matched them pretty well after that. So, you know, they were 41 points up at the end of the first quarter. They won by 48. But in that first quarter, like spot on, I mean, our kicking was woeful. I think we would struggle to come up with the six-day break. And I know this sounds like you're making an excuse, but I thought it was interesting. There was someone on Demonland, I wrote down the name, who said that flu went through the team, wasn't a new poster. So
yeah, I think that was Chris Scott said that.
Yeah, and it wouldn't shock me. It wouldn't surprise me because they looked fatigued and off right from the get-go. They definitely jumped us, and I think we did struggle with the pressure. Their physical pressure, they were a lot harder at it than us. Just the pressure rating was high, but they smashed us for contested possessions as well. You know, they've got some bloody good players. I mean, what's his name? Tracy looks like a man mountain.
He's incredible. You know,
this sounds a bit obvious, but we've got a poor kicking side, and I've been talking about this for 10 years. And so it isn't actually a shock, you know, that our kicking wasn't great under pressure, which is why I said on the other pod last week is that pressure is still king. Come finals and when the whips are cracking, pressure and contest is still going to be super important. But, you know, I think we have improved our ball use when you move out three ball butchers like May, Clary and Track and bring in other you know, quality players like Latrell who didn't get much of the footy. I think the biggest issue, well, what was watching, I have to watch the game. I didn't get a chance to watch it a second time, so I want to watch it again tomorrow before I do the stats. The thing that frustrated me the most, and I think it was massive, was our fumbling in that first quarter. Like Rivers, like so many players fumbled. It was unbelievable. Now, that's pressure, but it's also skill, isn't it? Like it's also
some of it wasn't pressure. Like it was a pressure environment, but some of they just missed. The handball was okay. It was the player receiving was just
Which is again without at the risk of banging on about it. Which is really why I like this ball use equity, because if you just look at the raw old numbers, our disposal efficiency was 68.8, which is not great at AFL standard. The average AFL was 73. Our kicking efficiency was 64. Across the AFL, 67.4% is the average. So it wasn't even down that much. It wasn't even down much on how they used the ball by foot. But it's not a very helpful thing, though, because it's ball use when equity, when it's all aggregated up. It looks every time a player uses the ball, whether that increases the probability of your team scoring or decreases the probability or increases the opposition scoring. And that's, you know, it was woeful. They're 26.9 points to their 71.3. They just demolished us in that space. By contrast, just the AFL average for that ball use equity points for all teams across every team is 52.9 per game. We were 26, almost half the AFL average of how impactful the use of the ball is. That's what that measure is, and that's why it's helpful. So we were half as impactful as the opposition. We averaged, by the way, in that stat last year for ball use equity, 39.6. So we were woeful kicking side last year. We were 13 points down on our average from last year. So it was poor from that perspective. It was a lot of that damage was done in the first quarter. I think the six-day break, I talked about it last year all the time. I followed this for a long time in terms terms of my betting strategy. It has a massive impact. We played Sunday afternoon at 3:15. Basically, that means you almost got one less day because you've got like it's Sunday night, but you know they're not home by 11 or whatever. A repair, and we fly out on the Friday night. So the Saturday, did we leave for a game in Perth?
Played on Saturday.
And there were a couple of players again. I don't want to harp on Langford, but I don't know. He looked.
We're gonna harp on him.
But the thing that frustrated me the most, and it was super damaging, was and right from the very first few minutes was our fumbles, and they cost us goal. Giath had a pretty good game, I thought, but like that first kick he had, where he just kicked directly to a Freo player, was like, you know, every Hawks fan in the land. One thing I did think early on in that game is I thought my man Oscar McDonald was playing for us. He was our best player at one point. He turned the ball over twice, but then in the sign of the game is that he was terrific after that and took intercept marks and hit up targets.
Well, we were kicking straight to him at times.
Come back, O-Mac.
And we'll talk about that right now because inside 50 connection and forward entries. So credit to Dubois has provided, he provided an inside 50 visualization, which you can see on the podcast thread on Demonland, that charts all of the inside 50s during the game and who the kickers were and who the targets were. I've abridged the post that he made about it, but the gist is as follows. We went inside 50 19 times with no identifiable target compared to just 4 times last week. And the results were as expected, turnovers, ground balls, and poor outcomes. Fritch was the main target, but entries to JVR and Majacek weren't high quality. Meanwhile, Freo scored heavily from outside 50 and were far more efficient. Is this a connection issue or something deeper with our forward setup? George, what do you make of the forward line entries, the inside 50 connections this week? After we were all blown away last week about when things were working for us and we were able to use our own system and everything was going well, we were blown away by it all last week.
The inside 50s basically is what we talked about before. It's coming from the midfield. And if the midfield's not, not delivering the ball properly or often enough, ultimately, the forwards can't do much about it. The other thing I think we were really, really, as a team, upset by the loss of Disco. All of a sudden we had to send someone down the back to play as the extra defender. We didn't have – we originally planning on JVR and Petty to be doing the ruck. Well, we couldn't afford to do that as perhaps we wanted to. We've got player at one stage. I saw JVR in the back line. I saw Majacek in the back line trying to fill holes. I think across the whole team, we were just struggling to just ultimately fill Disco's loss. It was just a cascading domino effect throughout the whole team. So back to the forward line. We didn't have the mids doing what they were meant to be doing, but ultimately Freo were while we were trying to get the ball up there, we were not kicking well. The fumbles were costing us. It wasn't clean like last week, and the sad reality is that the two practice games that we played, and also the St Kilda game that we played, I don't think any of them had a really genuine midfield. And we've come up against a genuine midfield in this Freo game, and we've been found wanting. So same as what we were talking about before in terms of the mids, we're going to expect more of this because we just don't have the right people in the right spots and the right type of players.
And just to sort of back that up, George, the in terms of where scores started for both teams, from the attacking midfield, we only scored 15 points from our attacking midfield setup. They scored 33 points from that, you know, more than double what we did out of their midfield. I thought that was a big factor. The other big factor in terms of the forward line and who you kicked it to is the lack of space. And that's directly related to two things. Is one, you know, as George said, how well the midfield delivered inside 50. And as I said, we only scored 15 points from our midfield. But the other thing is that from last week, you could see when you can transition the ball quickly with overlap handball, it has those long handballs create space inside 50 because the defenders have to come up to meet the player who's going to receive the handball and press up, which creates that opportunity to tic-tac and creates space inside 50 for the forwards to move into. Now, for whatever reason, you know, I think fatigue, you know, we struggle, but credit to also Frio's defensive system. They made it much harder than Saints did for us to move the footy. And so if you can't move the footy by hand, you can't get that overlap run, you can't get that happening, then you're not going to have the good looks, open space and leading lanes that we had last week. It's a bit of a chicken and the egg thing. So, you know, George is spot on. You can't sort of put it all towards the defenders. It's like it's a function of having space to move into is a function of how well you move the ball. But also I have to say credit to the Frio defensive team and that sort of discussion about whether we're in a rebuild or whatever is Frio are at the end of a 5-6 year journey at the moment where, you know, he's been building this plan for a long time. They play very, very similar to what King wants to. We're more direct, we're more territory, we're less disposals, but nonetheless lots of handballs overlap and probably, you know, they're a season team who have played this model now for 13, you know, a couple of years with some high-end talent. Their defensive system was super, and I think we struggled to navigate it, to be honest.
I think the other one last thing, I think we needed to move David Roden around a little bit during the game. He had 23 goals kicked over his hat for the whole game. Right. Wherever he was, the ball went over, was where the goals were scored. So, we needed to move him at certain times in the game, but unfortunately the AFL won't allow that.
There was a definite scoring end in that game.
It was good to see his smile, though, every time.
Yeah.
Just before you go on, Andy, because I'm going to forget this otherwise, there was another key stat, another thing that really was probably the reason we lost, and I think there should be an AFL investigation into this. I don't know if you noticed, but right at the start of the game, do you know what song they played? Bloody TNT by ACDC. Oh, that's our song.
It's, and then a play, Hell's Bells.
You know what song they played? Rock the Casbah.
No, so it was Hell's Bells, wasn't it?
Hell's Bells.
But in fairness to the Rock the Casbah, as I explained last week, every single AFL player, when it's your home game, has given the AFL or this ground or whatever a song. So someone's chosen Rock the Casbah. It wasn't one of those drafts where once you've taken a song, that's it.
There's approximately a trillion songs being recorded in history and, you know, how many AFL players and they have to choose Rock the Casbah?
I think one of the players has chosen a Wiggles song in the piece. I can't remember who. Wiley D asks, what was the difference between quarter one and quarter two? From a stats perspective, Frio had nearly 50 more possessions, 18 more inside 50s, etc. And watching it in quarter one, we looked completely gassed. Our kicks fell short. We were rushed when we had it, and they had free plays everywhere on the turnover. In quarter two, they suddenly seemed no longer to have free plays up the ground, and the Ds were able to retain possession and control the game. Was there a structural shift? Was our pressure better, or did we simply start winning the ball and stop turning it over? I was greatly impressed with our comeback, albeit quarter three was a disaster, but hoping to get your analysis on anything that Stephen King did or the players changed. Guy Lordy asks, this might be a bit naive, but we weren't playing man-on-man in the first quarter. We were we zoning, or is there no such thing in these days of helter-skelter football? We really did look like witches' hats at times. Frio seemed always to have a receiver waiting on the outside. Clintosaurus asks, thoughts on the setup at boundary throw-ins? And around the ground, stoppages look like we left open space every time, and they took full advantage of it. So, Bimanda, Frio didn't allow us to play the game on our terms. We've spoken about that, and we really seem to struggle to adapt and adjust. But if you want to answer any of those questions, particularly anything that King or the players did in the second quarter.
Yeah, it's a good question whether King pulled any sort of levers or reins to change it structurally. I actually think that sort of the main thing was that we did look gassed in the first quarter and they were running on top of the ground. Similar thing happened against the Cats. I don't know if you watched that game, but they were unbelievably dominant and their run fell away and Cats ultimately won that game. Very similar pattern in this game. And so, you know, it probably stands to reason their best quarters were their first quarter and third quarter, third quarter after a break. If you like, their running was unbelievable. Like the amount of all team running they did. Players with the ball, players without the ball. They ran us into the ground. And they had a clear strategy. They've done that every time they played us. And they clearly had a strategy to do that. The number of, as I said, they had 110 meters gained by handball in that first quarter, which is just unbelievable, which means that they're really looking to exploit their run. And it sort of goes to, you know, it's logical to expect that that sort of running has a toll and that it's going to sort of taper off. And then perhaps, you know, you have your halftime break, fill up the tank and go again in the third quarter and taper off again in the last quarter. I think that was definitely a factor. The other big factor was that we actually started playing better ourselves. We fumbled less. We were hitting more targets. We were providing better options. I thought we battled pretty manfully down back, though, in general. We scored one of the things on that we didn't score anything at all hardly on turnover in the first quarter. We scored 41 points for the match. They scored 70 points on turnover, which really goes to that, you know, we scored 70 points last week. Teams that win the turnover are now winning 80-90% of the game. So, that was a big factor as our ball used to get better. They didn't hurt us on punish as much on turnover as they did in the first quarter. I think that we generally balanced up. I thought we were a bit fatigued, but also perhaps we were thrown off kilter by their attack on the ball and their contest, and we took some time to balance up. Just in terms of man on man, where no one plays man on man anymore, really. It's a zone defense all the way. I think it's going to be a huge challenge for all teams. My feeling is that, you know, King will want us to play attacking footy, but at some point or rather he's going to, we don't want to be giving up 100 points every week, that's for sure. The setups around the boundary on throw-ins ground is really interesting. At one point I read on the AFL app that after the game, just before, is we'd only scored, with 10 minutes to go in the game, we'd only scored 2 points from all clearances and stoppages in the game, the lowest ever, I think, for ever recorded. We ended up scoring 12 or something, or 15, because we scored a couple of goals late, but we were woeful in terms of our scores from stoppage. So I'm not quite sure in terms of how they set up. I really would love to see some analysis of how we set up and during the coverage of the game. One thing that's really interesting, though, is that we've got a really they got first possession from clearances at a much higher rate than we did in this game. But when we do win the clearance, we turn it into a first possession after that at a really high rate across the AFL. I think it's number 3 or something, and we did in this game too. So when we actually win the ball with a clearance, we're using it super well. It's just this year where we're getting beaten up around the stoppages, despite having Maxi, the best ruck in the AFL, running around for us.
Yeah, it's hard. None of us were physically at the game, so to answer that question about how we set up at stoppages, it's often hard to tell from just on the TV when you're at the ground. You sort of get a better sense of what's going on.
But they do seem to be, across the AFL, Dogs aren't doing this, across the AFL at centre square and stoppages, just as a generalisation, they seem to be much more space. They seem to be standing further from the drop of the ball. And you see it with Cozzy. He's often standing 10, 15 metres. So when the ball hits the deck, he's hitting the ball at speed.
Yeah, at speed.
And getting out the front, which probably speaks to that quality of the ball use. Once you get it, you punish.
Yeah. Well, Cozzy definitely this year has been very far away from the ball drop.
Yeah, and I think that seems to be a common thing, though. So, yeah. It's really interesting, isn't it? You know, after being for years and then being the best stoppage team in the AFL, we're not at the moment, that's for sure.
Demon Jack asks, should we be concerned about the form of Langford and Lindsay? Obviously, they're only second-year players and were high draft picks, so the talent isn't an issue. We are relying on young players stepping up this year, and so far these two are not looking as promising as last year. Are we expecting them to do too much? Is it a classic case of second-year blues? And Pingu asks, are we expecting too much from our young brigade? I really hope we're not seeing a case of second-year blues from the likes of Langford and Lindsay, because at times they looked a little out of their depth. They certainly weren't the only ones. Windsor looked that way too, and Trelly at times seemed exposed to not quite being ready for the big stage just yet. Maybe I'm expecting too much from these guys. They've been fast-tracked into trying to fill the void left by the sudden disappearance of our premiership midfield. So, George, how do you assess the development of our younger players versus the expectation that many are putting on them, given the need for their development to be fast-tracked due to the circumstances that we unfortunately find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think it's the expectations more than anything else. And the other thing is the traditional second-year blues is because oppositions learn to recognise individual players as being talented or not and put more time into them. They get away with it in the first year and all of a sudden they can't in the second. But I think the other thing that's going to affect not just our younger players, but across the whole league, is if you're playing this style of game, and a lot of clubs are playing this style of game this year, it's making bigger and greater demands upon the younger players who haven't yet got the bodies to be able to step up to AFL football. So throw it, certainly from last week in the against St Kilda, which was a more than warm game, and this week certainly was with the humidity, off a six-day break, it's not surprising that the guys who just looked completely out of it were all the younger ones. It's something we're going to have to get used to. What's really telling, I think, is it's not just affecting the younger ones, this style of play, but I saw tonight on the news that in this round alone, seven players did their hamstrings.
Including track.
Yeah, including track. But that's you know, people are going to be start asking the questions if you're expecting players to do a lot more running and short burst type running that is causing these injuries, it seems, then it's not surprising that the younger ones are also suffering. I think it's going to be across the whole field from the looks of things, even at this early stage. Seven in a round is just incredible. And they're not the ones that have occurred, they're not the, you know, 2 weeks back in three. The Nankervis
high
one
grade,
is,
those,
yeah, high grade, 6 to 8 weeks for Nankervis, 4 to 5 for Lynch. Petrarca's 8 weeks now, I think.
Did they say eight weeks?
Wow. Eight weeks, really?
There's the brown medal gone.
Bloody biggest fire in footy. He implied that there was hardly anything in it.
Yeah, well, it was innocuous. That's certainly the case.
Yeah, but, it did look innocuous compared to the other two in that game where they both. Christian Petrarca will be unavailable in the medium term with hamstring injury sustained at the MCG. That was Gold Coast, so I don't know if that didn't give a time.
Medium term, that's like, is that the news? Four to six.
That is
a big blow for, I mean, it really is interesting, isn't it, George, that, you know, the amount of running, and I mean, it's interesting they're already talking a little bit about is how much is the new rules got to do with that. I think that it's been interesting, but it's like, again, like I said last year with the new rules, is beware the unintended consequences, and maybe this is an unintended consequences. Just work credit where it's due. Under Selwyn Griffith, the D's as high performance manager, we've had just incredible run with soft tissue injuries, and so much credit needs to go to him for, and that was true under Burgess as well. We haven't had any really, have we had any soft tissue injuries in any of the practice games, or not in the first two games?
Not in the practice games, no.
Yeah,
the other really bad one on the weekend was Butters, diving for a tackle, and he could not get off the ground. He had to be carried off the ground.
The other one I saw that was really bad, George, now we're talking like it's like a hamstring injury sort of show. And another big blow. I hate it when you see these players. Archie, you could see it basically stretching to do a, to make a spoil for Adelaide, and bang, high top part of his thing. He reached for it straight away. That's probably 6 to 8 weeks as well. And then, you know, as players often struggle to get back up after a hamstring injury in terms of because they're off legs, obviously. I mean, I make fun with track. I hope he does really well, and it's awful to see those injuries, and I feel badly for him. It's great for us because we play him in 2 weeks' time.
Yes, so let's get into let's take 1 week at a time and talk about the game this week. The Demons return to the MCG on Sunday and be looking to atone for a dismal performance in Perth as they take on the always, it seems, under the pump, Blues who are coming off an extended break due to the bye this week. I wonder how that's going to affect them, whether that's a benefit or not. Binman, followed by George, your preview of the match against the Blues, including any changes or any thing that you noticed from the Casey game, any changes you're going to make this week, and just a preview in general. I would assume Disco is going to be missing this week, so we're going to have to fill a role in defence.
This is a really excellent game for us in years gone past, not so much last year, but in, you know, in 23-24, Melbourne and Carlton played almost an identical game plan, and now we've got a different method, still territory like Carlton as well. They remain their number one in the AFL for contested ball. In terms of that ball use equity, ball winning equity, they're, I think, number two or number three for ball equity use. But they're down the bottom of the table of how well they use the ball. So I think that, you know, it's going to be a great team for us to come up against after last week. I think we'll win this game, and I think we'll win well. I'm really confident about this game. I think we'll have too much run. We'll look to attack. They are slow across the ground. We'll look to do what to them, to what Freo looked to do to us in every other game for the last 6 years, run us off. We'll look to run them off their feet. I wouldn't be shocked if they've targeted this game. Guerra's clearly got an eye to the MCG being an experience. I have to say I like what he's done. It seems to me a no-brainer coming out of that big, you know, the bigger race and all of that stuff. And so it wouldn't shock me if in their planning they've targeted this game, big game against the Blues. We owe them. You know, for me, it's as simple as ball winning versus ball use. If as long as we're not as diabolical with the ball in terms of our ball use as we were on the weekend, I think we'll have too much firepower for them. I think we'll move the ball too fast for them, too much spread. You know, their critical players are Cripps, who's number one, I think, in the AFL for contested, for his ball winning equity, for the points he gets. 8.4 he's averaging per game just for winning the footy, which is nuts. And Sam Walsh is 6.8. So for us, it's 6.5, Jack Steele, and then ridiculously Max Gawn, which probably points, it's not great having your ruckman being your second best winner of the footy, is it? Like, it just isn't, you know. But it just shows, I guess, how flexible he is. So I'm really confident in this game, and I think that if the weather isn't wet, then we'll be in really good shape. You know, I think really, to be honest, it's as simple as the ball winning versus ball use, and it'll come down to who uses the ball well. From the Casey game, I think George has sort of noted a bit, like really if the short summary of we were underwhelming in a lot of degrees. The only player really that I could see mounting a case to come into the scene is in the next 1 or 2 weeks, and it wouldn't shock me, is AMW. He looked AFL ready, and he looked a cut above.
Is there a chance he comes in this week?
It depends a little bit how quickly they want him in. I was saying to someone, is one of the things about King that's interesting is I reckon he's got a very clear best 23 in his head. And I guess perhaps all coaches do. I think that explains why they were so quick to bring Majacek and Cully back into the team off interrupted pre-seasons. Cully in particular, he didn't play anything in any of those intra-club games, straight back into the ones. I think he's got a clear sense of who his best 23 is, and I think AMW is in it. So I think that there's a good chance he will bring him in this week for that reason. You know, we just need that small meat player to man when the ball hits the deck. They smashed us for ground ball gets, both forward of the ball everywhere, but forward of the contest, absolutely demolished us for post-clearance possession and ground ball gets. And in large part, not in large part, a big factor in that is we don't have a Hibbert or a Jets or one of those, or a Quain or one of those really.
Or a Bowie.
Or a Bowie, exactly, but with him out of the side. So I could see him coming
in. Or a McVee.
The other one I see best 23 didn't play in this game is Kenfield. I reckon they'll bring Kenfield back in straight away.
Well, he's not really, I don't think, yet.
Laurie was both our best midfielder, and he's the classic too good for VFL, not quite good enough with enough tricks for absolutely. AFL. Yeah. Melksham, I have to say, looks a million miles off.
He's finished as a player.
He looks like he's bigger. He's put
muscle on in the chest and he's thicker through the legs, whether that's a deliberate thing or it's a conditioning thing. I have no idea why they played him in the second half. I couldn't work out what was going on. He had a set shot right in front of me. He was right in front of me. He had his knee strapped to the up the wazoo, yep. His right knee, from the left forward pocket where, ordinarily he would kick on his right. He kicked a goal on the left foot, like from the boundary line almost, with his left foot, where it otherwise would have been a right. I was thinking, well, why is he playing? Like, what's the point of that? He shanked the kick. So AMW is probably realistically the only player I could see coming in from, and it could be this week. I'm really bullish about this game. I think that we'll win, and we'll win quite comfortably.
I think the replacement for Disco has to be T-Mac. We just need that body. I think the other thing that T-Mac will bring is stability into the back line. We were sixes and sevens in the last couple of weeks, even in the St Kilda game. I don't think Lever's a great leader, but T-Mac certainly is able to stabilise things. So I think we'll see him come in for Disco. AMW, I would be surprised if he comes in this week. While he's probably the right person to come in, he's been out for 12 months.
Yeah, no, great. You're probably right.
This was his first game against Footscray. He did very, very well. He was the standout by any measure in this game. So I think he'll be, give him a couple more weeks perhaps in that. I want to see Heath come in because here's an opportunity to do something to the opposition really unbalances them. Pittman isn't a great ruck, and they're going to struggle when they have to put Cripps into the ruck as a replacement, as the fill-in for when
I just can't see off. Us bringing Heath and T-Mac in. No. Yeah, I get what you're saying with
one's
both.
A defender, but one's a ruck.
So I know, but I don't know. I think you've made it too top heavy.
The fortunate thing is Carlton have got a very simple game plan. It's called kick it to Mackay. It used to be kick it to Mackay and Curnow, but they haven't got Curnow now. So it just keeps failing. So we've got a real opportunity to really get rid of Michael Voss this week, and I reckon we should do it. Could.
Would have loved if Richmond had beaten them.
The selection thing is always a bit of is it who – you would select if you were the coach, and George would obviously select Heath, and who will actually be selected, and Heath won't be selected. And I don't think I'm in the camp of I wouldn't either. There is, I think, a real conversation that three of us have had every season for the last 5 years, which is do you rest Maxi at some stage? I would be all up for that to give him around the, the ridiculous thing is we don't have a bloody bye till round 16. It's a joke. It's a total joke. Hawthorn will have had two by then. Hawthorn don't play again another game till bloody Easter Sunday or some such. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, they've got 18 days. Carlton, I think, we're playing Gold Coast next week, who'll have had a bye before. They've got to buy this week, Gold Coast, and then we play them next week. So,
but it just, with Maxi, he's been in our top two players the first two games, and he's been, amazing. He was our best player in this game. If you ask him, and you can, Andy, when you see him next time, is that he doesn't want another ruckman in there, and it would appear that King is in that. 8-day break is massive. 8-day break is huge. We'll recover, no worries, from this game. The weather on Sunday is partly cloudy. Slight chance of a shower, most likely in the morning, though. Light winds, so perfect day for footy on Sunday. I reckon we'll be ramped up for this. The other player, just quickly about Casey, who I have to say I was disappointed in, and was Taylor. I'm as I was saying before, I'm a big student of body language. I really dislike poor body language, and I thought his body language was at some stages I would have dragged him. He was better both body language and performance after the first quarter in particular, and then in the second half I can see his tools, but he looks like he needs another serious 6 months in the gym, and maybe I'm overreading it, but someone put this on Demon Land, and that, he worried that he's cracking the sads because he didn't get selected in round one or round two. That's probably unfair on him, but if I was perfectly honest, that exact thought went through my mind when I was watching him on Saturday. Is he just didn't look invested in that
game, and it was a real worry for two reasons. One of which, it's his first game of footy, for a serious game of footy against blokes, against adults for the Melbourne Footy Club. And second is that was supposed to be his one wood, a relentless competitiveness, refusal to lose the contest, you know, supposed to be what was one of his key things he was drafted for. So, yeah, I was a bit disappointed. Who knows? Maybe there was a flu going through the club, and that was a factor in both teams' performances. That would be, you know, not great if that was true, but it may be, because he looked lethargic, a bit like Langford, I have to say.
Is this our replacement game, by the way, in terms of whether we need a ticket to get in?
I know it. No, isn't this a home game?
No, it's a away game.
No, it's away.
Ah. I don't know. I have to watch it as live, because
I think it is our away, because one of my memberships is a GA, general admission rep game adult. So replacement game, I'm sure that means. So
I can't go. I'm away. I'm up in Echuca paddling, and so I'm going to miss this game, and which will mean we'll win, because all the heartbreak I've had against the bloody Blues, like
we had the wood on them for a long time, and they've won since the final that they beat us in. I think they've won every game since then. I think we've lost since the 2023 final against them. I think we've lost every game we've played against them.
I've still got nightmares about that final.
Lost three or four in a row against them. So
as George said, we owe them. You know. Let's just heap the pressure on Voss. And what's going to be fascinating is I think there's no doubt that we'll look to attack, we'll look for overlap run, we'll be playing direct footy. And I don't think they've got the leg speed to go with us. We'll put them under pressure. The thing about any club now who can put Carlton under pressure at this point in time is that surely in the back of the player's mind is, oh no, is this going to be the one that's going to cause Voss to get sacked? Like, and who, you know, like Melbourne fans know better than any people about like how that can seep into the sort of walls of a footy club.
I think the one of the important things was if we put Colt on Walsh, that leaves Cripps as their only other option. And while we let Brayshaw off the rope this week, I don't think Carlton have got too many other options around to be able to.
We didn't talk about Colt and his tagging job. So yeah. While we're still only at an hour and 22 minutes, we do have time that we can discuss that, and also whether you think we'll put time into it, B-Man or George, if you want to take what you thought of Colt's game.
He did the job. You know, to cut down Sarong to bugger all possessions, which is fantastic. But the trouble is, you shut down one and you still leave a Brayshaw off the.
So, what do you think of 16
that? 16 possessions in the first quarter alone, he got, and he only got 14 for the entire match, Brayshaw against the Cats. And that's what Goody used to always say about tagging is that, you know.
Yeah. So, what do you think of that? Should we be tagged? Should we be doing that?
it's the eternal question. You know, do you get more out of tagging, shutting down a Walsh, or do you get more out of running up an extra player through the middle? I would prefer the first option, because I think Walsh is far superior to what Colt can produce. So I'd be going that way this week.
And look, I thought he did pretty well too, like Colt, and it really goes to the impact of what your players though. So Sarong was quiet, but he still had a rating of 14.6. Like 20 is an elite game of footy. 14.6 is better than Tracy. He scored better than Tracy, put it that way. Yeah. He scored more than Cozzy, Sarong did. He had, where was it? He had ball winning 6.6 points. He had ball use 6.8. So he still hurt us. He still hurt us despite being tagged. And conversely, Colt almost had no impact on our score, which is again why I like that scoring thing. He only scored his player rating was 0.2, so he really had no sort of definable impact on the capacity to score. Actually, he didn't increase the probability we would score with his actions. And Sarong, who he was tagging, still had a relatively influential game. So, you know, it's a bit. Yeah, good, I'm good, not good players. On it.
good players will always hurt you. And they don't need much opportunity. But yeah, it would have been. It could well have been a lot worse if you know Sarong had 30 possessions and Brayshaw 38 or whatever he got.
Yeah, and the other thing about like using Colt as a tagger is that it gives him a bit of an out in terms of he kept his thing quiet, but his ball use. The equity points was negative 0.1. That means he gave up the ball and they punished us and scored from his involvements. And could he go with – who would you put him on, Walsh? I mean, Walsh. He could run with him. I mean, yeah. I like the fact that he gives him a job and that I think it brings him to the footy. But, if you took out Walsh, that would go a long way to sort of helping us sort of negate the strength of their midfield. You couldn't put him on Cripps is a man mountain.
Lift him up and throw him over the fence like Voss was threatening to.
The one that's escaped a little bit of like time, we got 1 minute, is Latrell. It wasn't a good game by Latrell. Yeah,
someone
it?
Mentioned him earlier in one of the questions when we talk about the young guys, but do you think he might get dropped?
For Max Heath.
Well, forget who for. Just do you think they might think maybe he's not ready? I'd still like it because it's that.
I don't think he'll get dropped because
it's the what he can do, the prospect of what he could possibly do. But he really just looked lost. They coughed it up a couple of times.
He
did look lost. I'll admit that. I loved him in the first week. I've loved those glimpses of what we've seen, and I know that potentially can do it to light up the G. But yeah, he was pretty poor this week. So
he didn't even have a score involvement. So, you know, that's the I don't think he'll get dropped because, again, it goes to, well, what are we trying to achieve this year? And goes to George's point, being, okay, who are you going to bring in? It's probably not going to be Heath.
Well, they could bring in a Laurie maybe in the forward line. I'll take Trelly.
I mean, Latrell's the future, isn't he? So you've got to get games into him. And, for all of the criticism of Goody last year, or forever and a day, is credit where credit is due. He put games into Lindsay, into, he was select five debutants in his first year. And, you've got to get 50, 60 games into these lads. And the only way to do that is to pick him in the seniors. So I can't see him going anywhere, to be honest. Not at the moment. You can't have two or three games like that in a row, then he'll certainly be in the frame for being dropped. But no, Tom Matthews, he looked good, but he's miles off an AFL player.
We know that,
He'll be spectacular when he does come in.
Yeah, he took almost a couple of total screamers.
But was completely missing for three quarters.
Yeah.
It didn't seem.
Yeah. And that's going to happen for small forwards, I think.
Yeah.
But we do actually, we need that small forward up, to be causing damage inside our 50s.
All right. Well, that's where I think we're going to leave it for tonight, under an hour and 30 minutes. I think my new regime is working wonders here. We'll be back next week to break down our round 3 match against the Blues. Look out for our extended Stats Files podcast in the coming days if you enjoy that deeper dive into the stats that matter. Thank you to our 5-star reviewer on Apple Podcasts. That was thank you to Hang On, Helmers on the way. And as always, your questions and comments are an integral part of this show. So thank you to our Demoland posters who submitted questions and comments. Thank you to Lazy, Harp and D, Spirit of Norm Smith, Bowser Power, Radelaide, Gorn of the Dead, Monocular, Pew Pew Pew, Demon WA, Wells 11, Credit to Dubois, Wiley D, Go Lordy, Clintosaurus, Demon Jack 14, Pingu and D for Life. And thank you to my co-hosts, George and B-Man, and thank you to you, our loyal listeners. Don't forget, leave us a 5-star review and a comment on Apple Podcasts and we'll read it and give you that shout out on the next podcast. Go Demons.
Go Red Leggers.
It's a grand old flag. It's a high-flying flag. It's an emblem for me and for you. Well, it's the emblem of the team. Team of the red and the blue. Well, every heart beats true for the red and the blue as we sing a song for you. Should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the red and the blue. Oh, where the team played fine in the year 39, where the team that no one can lick. Find us there after the final bell with the spirit of 1926. Well, every heart beats true. sing this song to you. Should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on